Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to Sangoma, Stories from the Frontlines of Mediation. I'm your host, Batabi Lim Company, mediator and negotiation coach, and I'm so happy to welcome you to the show today. I'm excited to be welcoming our guest. Her name is Lisa Renee Pomerantz, and I hope I'm pronouncing her last name correctly. I'm sure she's going to tell me. But I'm excited to have her today because she's one of those who is combining conventional law practice and mediation ADR practice. And I'm really interested in how she's doing that because it's something that I have wanted to do myself. So we're going to dive right into the show today, and I'm going to bring her on. Lisa, I'm turning on your microphone. Say hello to everyone, please.
Hello, everybody. I'm delighted to be here this evening.
Wonderful. And, you know, Lisa, we ran into each other at the ACRGNY conference a few weeks ago. I was so delighted to see your presentation there and to get to meet you in person for just a moment, and I'm glad to be able to chat with you again.
My pleasure.
Well, you know, Sangoma is a show that is about stories, stories from the front lines of mediation, of course, is the tagline. And so I'm really fascinated by your story, and I'm hoping that we can share that with our audience today. I want to talk about the things that ultimately have brought you into your profession that inform how you approach your work, and then talk a bit about your work as well. But let's go back a bit and talk about how you became Lisa. And I see here from the notes that I have that you lived in a number of places here in the United States. You say that you've never attended the same school for more than 2 years in a row, and so you have had to develop a way of getting to know people and being comfortable with people who are different from who you are. Tell me a bit more about that.
Okay. Actually, I was... I'm the daughter of a retired law professor, and my mother is a biochemist. And a lot of the moving around was necessitated by one or the other of them making a career move. And so that's really why we moved around, and we, at least two or three of the places we lived, were actually college towns because my parents were employed by the local university.
So you have grown up in an academic atmosphere, at the same time having to manage finding your way in places that were different. What was that like? Do you remember the first time you moved?
Well, actually, I don't remember. The first time I moved, I was 3 months old. Then I moved when I was 2, and I only vaguely remember that because we had a dog when we lived in Virginia, and then we moved to an apartment in Queens, and we had to dispense with the dog. So I have vague memories of that. But we lived in Queens for about 6 years and then moved out to Long Island, so that was my first stint on Long Island many, many years ago. Then we moved to Austin, Texas. And I certainly remember the moves from Queens to Long Island and from Long Island to Texas and then Texas to Virginia, with my parents having spent a year in Illinois when I didn't join them and I lived on my own. I was at a boarding school. I was 13. So those were sort of formative experiences.
I can imagine. How would you prepare yourself for moving?
I don't think we were ever well prepared. Whenever we moved somewhere, I never had the right clothes. I graduated, actually, from a Southern Girls Episcopalian finishing school in Charlottesville, Virginia, and went to what was then Radcliffe, now Harvard, and absolutely did not have enough warm clothes. So, plus, at the time, I had an accent that nobody could understand, and it was pretty much the story whenever we moved that I never had the right clothes and nobody could understand me. And so, actually, I think I learned to pick up accents pretty quickly and to get with the swing of things as far as fashion.
You know, what I'm curious about as you're telling me this is how you chose to approach sort of being the odd person out whenever you move. Because what you're describing, especially when you're talking about a tween or a teenager where belonging and having a clique is so important, and you know it's something that everybody strives for. You arrive in a new town, you are not wearing the right clothes, your accent is different, so you know you're an outlier in a sense. Is that something that was painful for you, or something that was a joyous challenge for you? I know different people would have different experiences of that.
Well, I think I just took it to be the norm. Adding to the challenge was that I had skipped second and third grade and was 2 years younger than everybody. So I think I just took changing schools almost, you know, every year or every other year is, for me, that was normal. And I guess, I was always athletic, so I tended to make friends with boys, I think, and so maybe being part of the girl clique was not really my thing anyway.
So then worrying about clothes and hairstyles and makeup styles was not necessarily that big of a deal for you?
Well, I don't. Not in the sense that I felt I needed to conform. I interestingly, my grandmother, who came to this country in 1940, escaping the Nazis, became a very successful fashion designer. So I don't want to say, and she had a tremendous sense of style. And I also, my father's cousin happened to be a designer also. So I don't want to say that fashion was not important to me. But not in the sense of keeping up with whatever the fashion of the day was. And my parents were, number one, fairly clueless, and number two, not very, I think being academics, not especially sympathetic to the notion that we had to have whatever the latest styles were.
Sure. You know, speaking of fitting in and conforming and so forth, you mentioned that you graduated from an Episcopalian girls' finishing school.
Yes.
But you're Jewish.
Absolutely.
How
did that come about?
I'm curious about how does one navigate that?
Well, actually, that was my second Episcopalian school that I had gone to. I had also attended one in Austin, Texas. And the story was that we lived in Charlottesville, Virginia, and there were the public schools, which were not particularly well-regarded academically. There was a segregationist academy, and there was no way my parents were sending me to that. Mm-hmm. And there was St. Anne's. And St. Anne's was supposed to be the best academically, and so that's why I ended up going there. I would say I just recently came back from my 40th high school reunion, and my class of 40 did actually have three Jewish girls, all of whom showed up for the reunion, so I was not completely alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the religion was especially an important part of the education there.
Well, I was going to ask, did people know you were Jewish?
Yes, but there was really a defining event that occurred. There was a certain amount of anti-Semitism, and there were several members of my class who belonged to the local country club that did not allow Jewish or black people. And when we were deciding where to have our senior class dinner, there were several people who wanted to have it at this country club. And I basically, this is something I really remember, standing up and saying that if they considered me part of the class, we wouldn't have it there. And only one or two people said that nobody would notice, but everybody else got it, and so we had it somewhere else.
That, you know, requires a great deal of both courage and sense of self. Did you struggle over whether to say something?
No, I did not. I guess maybe it's because my parents were academics, and both of my grandmothers were very accomplished women, and my mother is a biochemist, and I was brought up to question things and to say what I thought. And so I don't think I really had a lot of trouble saying that. And at the reunion, in fact, people said to me that I was the only person who knew what was going on and in the world, and that I would say that to everybody else. Hmm. So I think I was pretty outspoken then.
Right, and it certainly sounds like it made an impression on your classmates.
Yes, but I did get along with them.
Right. Well, it's an important event, I think, you know, both for you and then also for your classmates. Perhaps it's something that they hadn't had to really think about before until it comes up, and now they have to make a decision that says we're going to forgo this experience that we desire because we're going to act in solidarity with our classmates.
Right. I do think that was an important event, and that everybody or most people understood where I was coming from and were sympathetic. I mean, Charlottesville was a completely different world back then. As a matter of fact, I think until my senior year in high school, the University of Virginia was all male. Mm-hmm. So it was really just a completely different world.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you graduate and you end up going to what was then Radcliffe and
yes.
Harvard now. And then you continued on to law school. But I'm curious about now, coming to a place where you're settled. I am assuming that you did all 4 years at Harvard.
Yes, I did.
And the way you say that makes it sound like an accomplishment.
Actually, I was not a big fan of Harvard. It was very hard to get into Harvard, but I wouldn't say it was either the most welcoming or the most demanding place. So, and I think I was in college at a time when many people were rather alienated, but I slogged my way through and was in the middle of the class, and, you know, it was what it was.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I did speak up there, though. One of the funny stories is that I was in the first class of girls who lived in Harvard Yard. And they never had to deal with what they were going to do as far as girls and intramural athletics. So I, of course, being an athlete, blazed the trail, had my picture in the paper playing touch football, and was the girls' equivalent of an athletic secretary. But the boys who did that job got paid, and the girls did not. And when I raised that issue with the then president of Radcliffe College, she said I should consider myself honored to have that position.
Wow. This is coming from the president of Radcliffe.
Correct. One of the things about Radcliffe is that the only reason it existed was to make it harder for girls to get into Radcliffe and to get financial aid. So once they did away with it, there were many more women at Harvard, and the financial aid was more equitably distributed.
Wait, I'm not getting that.
When I went to Radcliffe, the girls went to Radcliffe, the boys went to Harvard.
Right.
So the size of Radcliffe was roughly maybe 25% of Harvard.
Oh.
So they kept the population of girl students low, and of course, Harvard had a better endowment, so there was more generous financial aid to the boys than the girls. When they finally did away with Radcliffe, all of that evened out.
Right. Okay. Okay. I understand. So you're told that you should feel, you know, honored to have this position. Did it end there?
I think I just always laughed about it.
Hmm.
I mean, I didn't pursue it because I was happy to do it. But I did think it was, you know, it missed an important point.
Sure. Sure. And what I'm reacting to really is the fact that it was another woman who said this to you.
Well, I think, yes, there were a lot of things about Harvard that were inequitable, and I really don't think that the administration really caught on. I mean, I was on the tennis team. We had the assistant crew coach as a coach. He knew nothing about tennis, but the boys' tennis team, you know, had a much more experienced and knowledgeable coach. We had to play on these courts that were like half an hour away from the main campus. You know, there was just a lot of things that happened but I guess they were just going through whatever, the adjustment pains of becoming truly co-ed. I mean, that, you know, all the Ivies were becoming co-ed at that point. They were not alone in making that adjustment.
True. You know, I attended Princeton myself, and the story goes that the Mute Olympics at Princeton, which have now been so well done away with, that when I go back on campus and I ask current undergraduates about it, they have no knowledge of it whatsoever, which surprises me. But Princeton used to have what was called the Mute Olympics, where on the first night that it snowed and the snow stuck, members of the sophomore class would get together in Holder Courtyard, which is the oldest courtyard on campus, and get stripped down to shoes and scarves and run around the courtyard in a very organized fashion, I should say. And there was a prescribed number of times you'd run around, and then there were, you know, exercises that one would do, and then, you know, folks would go off into the night. And it did become quite a liability for the university, and they finally have absolutely done away with it. I mean, I think that if anybody tries to do it, it's an immediate expulsion. But the story goes that the Mute Olympics was started in order to make the women who were now coming onto Princeton's campus as it was becoming co-ed, to make them uncomfortable and leave. And it turns out that quite the opposite happened. And the women just joined in.
That's a funny story, too.
So I'm wondering if you had any similar experiences at Harvard as you are now involved in integrating the university.
Not really. I mean, to me, Radcliffe was just, I used to say it was a figment of the alumna imagination because I lived at Harvard Yard. I lived at one of the Harvard colleges. I attended the classes. Radcliffe really didn't have much of a meaning to me. And I think partially because I was, not that I did have women friends, but also because I remained very active in sports, I had a lot of guy friends too.
Mm-hmm. And did the guys bring up the issue of women coming in? I mean, you know, as you see with Princeton, there was a bit of a backlash going on. I guess they were very male-identified. Princeton's sister school was far away, so it wasn't like having Radcliffe there where you have a long history of women being around. I mean, Princeton apparently was really all male. So perhaps it was more likely that there was going to be a backlash there than at Harvard. But did the guys say anything about it?
No, the only thing was that there was a lot of joking about the guys dating women from less academically prestigious schools,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to dating the students who went to Radcliffe, although that was not my personal experience.
Okay. Well, it sounds like it was kind of an even keel, as you described it, sort of an even keel kind of experience that you had there at Harvard, and then you decide to go to law school. Was law school something that you chose to do, or, you know, I know in some families it's sort of a default. You have just a couple choices. You can be a doctor, a lawyer, or professor.
I think what happened was, first of all, I'm third generation lawyer, and I can't say that my parents insisted I go to law school, but I think they insisted on that I find a direction. And I took the LSATs, and I did very well. And I had had summer jobs working in law schools, you know, in, like, law school libraries. So I do think it was somewhat by default that I ended up going to law school. It seemed like I had an aptitude for it, and I was, you know, pretty accustomed to what was involved.
Mm-hmm. And when you were in law school, how would you describe your experience?
Actually, I had a great experience at BU Law School, and that's really where my loyalties lie. I always felt it was kind of the Avis to Harvard's Hertz, in that they were number two but trying harder. And I had excellent professors. I enjoyed the classwork. I was on the law review. And I had good friends, and I would say it was a very good experience.
Mm. I'm happy to hear that for you. It seems an unfortunately rare report of law school. Most of the folks I speak to who went to law school don't speak of it in such glowing terms as you do.
No, I have very fond feelings about BU Law School.
Right, right.
And I continue to do so because I read the material that they send. And as you know, there's a glut of lawyers on the market, but I think that they are doing tremendously innovative things about having different kinds of tracks so that the students who come out of law school are better prepared for real jobs. So, again, as I said, I continue to hold them in high regard.
Okay, wonderful, wonderful. It sounds like they have a greater emphasis on practical education rather than the theoretical.
I would say both.
Okay.
I thought both.
Okay.
I personally think both are very important. But I just think maybe that because they were ambitious as an institution, that they were willing to be kind of entrepreneurial.
Okay.
And inventive.
Which, near to your benefit, of course. I remember coming out of law school myself and knowing that I had all these wonderful, you know, philosophical and theoretical ideas about the law, and didn't know how to put a blueback on to a pleading for even what a blueback was. But, you know, it sounds as though there was some balance there for you. And indeed, after you finished law school, you did go into the practice of law. What was that like for you?
Well, actually what happened is I clerked for a federal judge for a year, which was a great experience. And then I practiced law for about 7 years as a litigator and absolutely hated it, despised it. I thought people treated each other, the lawyers treated each other abominably. In Massachusetts, they didn't have the assigned judge system, so you were constantly going, every time you went to court on a case, you were going in front of a different judge. And so people could pretty much lie routinely without being caught. And I thought litigation was a huge waste of time, money, emotional, energy. And so I remember having breakfast with my father who said, you know, you cannot spend the rest of your life doing something that you hate.
Mm.
So that's when I decided to make a career change.
Right, right. So, of course, it sounds like at that time, as you are practicing law and hating it, that you may have had a conception that there was something out there that was better.
Well, one of the things that I noticed was that I seemed to be pretty good at predicting how cases would be resolved. years later, and I thought that much of what was going on as far as discovery and motion practice, you know, was not really especially useful in terms of finding out either the facts or advancing the parties or the judges' understanding of what was going on.
Uh-huh.
And I felt the other thing was that I felt that often contracts were not drafted in a way to maximize the chances of the parties having a successful business relationship, and they weren't addressing the issues that needed to be addressed. So I basically made a decision that I wanted to change careers and find an in-house job, and if I could not do that, I was going to go back to business school.
Wow. That's significant.
So
that is a change.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I just had to get out of it. So what happened is I had been dating Lance, who is now my husband of almost 24 years. But
congratulations.
He was he had moved back to Long Island, and we had a long-distance relationship, and I basically wrote to all the corporations headquartered on Long Island, and I got a job at NEC.
I see. All right. And you go in-house. What is that experience like for you? I'm guessing that you had an opportunity to change the way that you were practicing.
Oh, I loved it. Because I had the background in litigation, I became responsible for managing the dispute resolution activities, including managing litigation. I also implemented some procedures for the early neutral evaluation of disputes as they arose, and was instrumental in resolving many disputes without litigation. In fact, I won an employee recognition award for doing that. And I also, for the first time, had to learn how to become a transactional lawyer, which I love.
Yeah.
And what I especially loved about working in-house was working on teams with people from different professional backgrounds who would look at problems from a different perspective. So I would be working on initiatives with people from sales, marketing, training, contract administration, customer service. And that is really, I think, where the beginning of my mediation career became, occurred, because I was kind of the honest broker there, and I would be listening to the interests of all the different departments and figuring out how we were going to accomplish some initiative that management had, you know, given us to take care of in a way that satisfied the needs and concerns of all the different departments.
Well, it sounds like this nurturing collaborations came kind of naturally to you.
Yes, it absolutely did. I loved it. I found that I was fascinated by all the different business departments, and that I was really interested in what they did and interested in learning about their perspectives and what they brought to the table. And I think, because you probably have gathered, I'm somebody who will, you know, tell it well, the way that I see it. I think people definitely trusted me, and that I really felt that the plans that we would come up with for different initiatives, you know, were definitely better because I had brought both this facilitation skills to the situation, as well as, you know, the subject matter expertise, which I brought, which was the legal aspect, to try to implement, whether it was a dealer loyalty program or some kind of new warranty program, or it could have been an acquisition, to do it in a way that maximized the chances of success and minimize the chances of future disputes. So it was I really enjoyed the work that I did there.
Well, you know, in addition to that, necessary to your enjoying the work and being so successful at it is having an environment that's receptive to it. And it sounds as though in this particular firm, folks were receptive to it, which didn't have to happen. How did that come about?
Well, it was a really interesting story. NEC, I don't know whether you know, is actually an American, or NEC America and then NEC USA, were actually American subsidiaries of a Japanese corporation. And the management structure was very interesting because much of the top level of management was actually Japanese executives assigned here from Japan. And the truth was that often they were sent here without adequate preparation. They often had language barriers. There were cultural barriers. They didn't know the legal system. And I think for some reason, even though women are not in a prominent position in Japan, that somehow I was like a third sex to them.
Uh-huh.
And that I think that they actually felt more comfortable confiding in me. It was less embarrassing than perhaps confiding in a male attorney. I'm not sure.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe I was more empathetic. And so I think that they thought that what I brought to the table was an empathy to their situation and an empathy to the goals that they were trying to achieve. And I treated everybody with respect, and I definitely, was valued by the Japanese executives as well as the American executives. But maybe it was the moving around so much that allowed me to sort of welcome the opportunity to get to know people from a different culture.
Right, right. And I certainly was looking at your background moving around and so forth as a link. You know, that's why we had spent some time talking about your background moving around and, you know, about the skills that one must learn as a person who moves around a lot and is integrating and reintegrating constantly. And so here's another situation where you have a unique sort of perspective in terms of integrating people who are coming in from a different country, a different culture, a different legal system, as you mentioned. And so you are quite well equipped to be able to help them. And then also because of their newness, it sounds like it was a sort of serendipitous situation for you where you were able to be influential in how the approach to collaborating and then also resolving disputes was concerned. So it does sound like it was a fabulous opportunity for you. Had you taken any mediation training up until this point or any ADR, have any ADR background?
The only ADR experience that I had when I worked at NEC was I did represent the company. I was the company representative at mediations. We always had outside counsel, but I attended, and also at arbitrations.
Right.
But I did a tremendous amount of just negotiating out disputes with customers and dealers and sales agents and vendors and companies from whom we acquired other companies. So I actually think that having training as a neutral or being able to be a neutral can make you a much more effective attorney because you can see the other side's interests and concerns. You can understand what they are, and you can be more creative in trying to address them.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Well, you've had this tremendous opportunity and are able to have this influence and win an award. And then things change. Talk to me about that.
Well, NEC, for a variety of reasons, was not doing very well. They had exited some of the businesses that they were in. They had actually acquired another computer company in what turned out to be a disastrous acquisition. And so the company was not doing well, and they decided to consolidate their various divisions into their Texas headquarters. And so my husband has his business here. We weren't going to relocate, and so I had to move on and figure out what to do next.
So what did you do next?
Well, the first thing I did was that I was hired as a subcontractor to write and do the voiceover on some employee compliance training programs. And Oracle Corporation, which was in some ways a similar, at least the products and services were similar to NEC, and therefore to some extent the legal issues, was the first client that this company had. And I loved the process. It was incredibly collaborative. I was sort of at the center with the company that had the contract. I worked with the attorneys from Oracle. I worked with the company that was the expert in, I guess, adult learning and online adult learning. So I worked with them in trying to figure out, you know, what was the best format for the different slides and quizzes and things like that. Unfortunately, the company I did that for as a subcontractor decided not to pursue that line of business. So that was really only for about a year. And so then I had to sort of resuscitate my nascent law practice in a situation where, although I had lived on Long Island for quite a while, since I wasn't here from here, and actually my business contacts were all over the country and in Europe and Japan, South America, but not on Long Island, so I sort of had to get myself known, and, you know, necessity is the mother of invention.
Oh, and it sounds like you are just doing what you've been doing for a lot of your life again, starting
exactly.
over again. So you were well equipped for doing that.
I was surprised because I had so much enjoyed being part of an organization like NEC and working with this team of, you know, existing team of people, and I didn't have to worry about where my paycheck was coming from, and I just went in and did my work. But I surprised myself because it turned out I really enjoyed the entrepreneurial adventure. And one of the first things that happened was, which was a good thing, was that I was accepted onto the AAA commercial panel.
As an arbitrator?
Yes. I'm also listed as a mediator, but I have never gotten a mediation case from them.
Ah, okay. So by this point, you know, you're now on the AAA and you're starting your own practice. Let me ask you about your practice. What did you decide to do as your practice? How did you decide to focus it?
Well, originally, I had tried to find another in-house counsel job. The only offer I had was in Manhattan, and I had two fairly young children at the time, and I thought, I am not spending 4 hours commuting. So I had approached some companies on Long Island that were larger and might have been big enough to have in-house counsel. And I actually got a few interviews, but I found that there were too many gatekeepers. Either there was a CFO who didn't want to spend the money, or there was an existing outside general counsel who was not thrilled at the idea of somebody else, you know, taking a job as in-house counsel.
Sure.
So I decided that I needed to focus on companies where they really didn't have an existing legal relationship. And so I also found that I really enjoyed working with entrepreneurs. I'd actually had some experience working with entrepreneurs at NEC because when we acquired some companies, some of the companies we acquired were sort of startups that made a product or something that we needed to add to our portfolio.
Uh-huh.
And then I sort of became like the integration liaison and sort of the mentor to the people whose company we had acquired in terms of like helping them adjust. So I did have experience working with entrepreneurs, and basically I started doing a lot of public speaking on topics that I thought would be of interest to entrepreneurs, and I became involved in the Suffolk County Women's Business Enterprise Coalition, which I ultimately chaired, which was a capacity-building organization for women entrepreneurs. And I basically, as I said, fished where the fish were.
Uh-huh. And knowing where the fish are is such a key factor in becoming a successful entrepreneur. Is there, you know, I know that there are people who are listening who are mediators who are trying their own hand at growing their practices. I am one of them. What do you say to folks who are entrepreneurs who are going out on this journey and are trying to find the fish and, you know, put out the right lure? What do you tell folks?
Well, I think what I would say, and I actually did talk about this topic at ACRGNY about developing your niche, is I think that you need to look at the situation from your client's perspective. What is it that your clients need? And I have some unconventional ideas maybe about what clients need. I mean, first of all, clients' priorities are to avoid disputes, not get into them so they can be resolved. So I feel that that mediation is only one step in a phase of what I would call conflict management. So, you know, there's training, there's transactional work. I like the idea in transactions of having a mediator specified in an agreement so that there's a mechanism for the parties to resolve issues as they arise. And I think the other perhaps misconception that some mediators may have is that subject matter expertise is not important, number one, and number two, I do feel that a neutral has some responsibility for assuring that a resolution sort of is viable and that there also is the opportunity to add some value in terms of getting everybody to a better place, because there often are several possible resolutions, and only the mediator may see that there are some gains for trade and be able to raise issues to accomplish this. To be more specific, I judged a mediation representation competition at Toro Law School that involved a fact pattern of a dispute between a key employee and a company, and part of the confidential information that only the mediator had was that really this key employee didn't really want to stay with this employer, and that the employer really didn't think that the key employee was especially suited to this job. And yet, and of course these were students, but I don't think the mediator should ignore the fact that maybe the best resolution for the parties is one that involves in such a circumstance, the parties parting ways.
Uh-huh.
And I think that knowing that information, and it doesn't mean that you're not neutral, but that you can actually improve both parties' positions by seeing how you can effectuate the communication of relevant information and brainstorm ways to get people what they really want.
Well, it sounds as though you're encouraging mediators to not to just be satisfied that the parties came to an agreement, whatever it is, they came to an agreement for whatever reason, but to be more actively involved in perhaps reality testing and have a concern about the outcome, not one way or the other, but for the good of everybody who's involved?
Absolutely. That's exactly right.
Okay. How was that for paraphrasing?
Perfect.
But yes, you make it a very important practice point for folks who are listening. There is that fine line, and it may be a delicate balance, but it is one of the ways in which a mediator as a third-party neutral can truly add value to a mediation, and it's something I think is important. In your practice, you are now able to combine the conventional practice of law, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like you're able to combine the conventional practice of law with your mediation background. Talk to me about how you do that.
Well, I have to say that I would like to do mediation more than I do. Often when people come to me with some kind of dispute, a partnership dispute or a vendor customer dispute, I often present them with the option of I can serve as a mediator to help the parties try to resolve this, or if you prefer to have your own representation, I can try to negotiate, a resolution for you. And most of the time, people pick having an attorney as opposed to a mediator. So, again, I feel that I'm there to offer the services that the client wants, and I'm respectful about that. I will say that I do more representation. I've done a fair amount of arbitration with the AAA. I do a fair amount of representing clients in mediation if I'm unsuccessful at resolving things informally. But I would actually say that a lot of the, quote, dispute resolution activities I'm involved in are really negotiating the resolution of disputes between business partners or vendors and customers, employers and employees. I tend to have a pretty good track record at achieving a negotiated resolution without the need for a third party neutral.
Right. Well, I'm curious about something that you just said. Do you have a sense as to why people seem to tend to choose representation over mediation?
I'm not saying that I can necessarily blame them, because I think that people do not necessarily have a good understanding of the strengths or weaknesses of their position, and they also, in the business context, for example, there are different ways that a business relationship could be restructured. So, number one, they don't have a good sense of their own position, and they may not have a good view of what the possible resolutions look like. So I can't, I'm not critical of at all of them for feeling more comfortable being represented. And, of course, in larger cases that do go to mediation, especially in the business context, typically the parties are represented by counsel.
In mediation anyway?
Yes.
Right, right. Well, it seems like it's an opportunity to have the best of both worlds.
It is, although I would say that, again, I do think training and training, and I guess in my case, I had an awful lot of kind of on-the-job mediation and facilitation experience, that I think it can make you a much more effective attorney from the negotiation perspective. And really obviate the need to have a mediator. I mean, one of the things, just so that you know, that I do whenever a client retains me, is one of the first things I do is what I would call an early neutral evaluation of their position, because I think one of the reasons that cases get stuck in litigation is that the counsel oversell the cases to their clients.
Okay. So you want to be really realistic with your client and then also help your client to get a realistic sense of what they actually want.
Well, I mean, I will try to understand. I mean, they're entitled to their own preferences, but I will certainly evaluate their position and see whether they're on strong ground or not. But then I will, you know, try to lay out what the different, I call them graceful exits, you know, what the different possible ways out might be. And, you know, when I communicate with the other party, or once they're represented by counsel, I try to keep everything in a very collaborative tone.
Well, you've anticipated my next question quite nicely, which is, you know, it's fine and dandy that you're doing this with your own client. There is the opposing party, and there's opposing counsel. What is your experience working with opposing counsel and coming in with a more, you know, collaborative attitude?
Well, I think it can be very effective. I mean, when I worked at NEC, the other attorneys that I was dealing with, typically were often in-house counsel for other companies, and they had sort of the same agenda that I did. But I do think that most attorneys recognize that litigation is a very expensive process, And does not necessarily serve their clients well. The other thing I would say is that I am a very effective and persuasive writer. And so typically what I do is, once I've analyzed the case, I write a very polite but persistent letter to either the party or the other side, you know, other side's attorney, explaining this, our view of the situation. And, you know, it's almost like a little brief. And, of course, I always indicate our willingness to consider any evidence or case law they might want to bring to our attention. You know, I basically get a dialogue going. And you know, I think that approach works very well.
So it has been successful for you. And that's interesting to note, because there is, of course, this prevailing wisdom, I suppose, about lawyers being tremendously adversarial, and that your approach might end up sort of backfiring in a sense, but it sounds like that's not the experience you're having.
No, and part of that also might be my personality. There have been some studies done that have found that most attorneys actually are pessimists, and so they tend to see the downsides and the risks in situations. And I think that's why the pessimists also especially tend to go into litigation. So I think that that by setting a different tone and a more positive tone and exploring the alternatives and the possibilities, that you know, you can change the tone of the discourse, number one. And number two, there are certainly attorneys who initially will react to me in an adversarial way, but I just ignore it.
Oh, you said you're persistent.
I'm persistent and I'm polite. So we just, and I think ultimately I'm able to establish a rapport with the attorneys on the other side and sort of enlist them in trying to help solve our client's problem.
Right. Well, there you said it in a very collaborative way. You know, you mentioned that you write and that you're a great persuasive writer, and I know that you also blog, I think, and you have a newsletter. I want to make sure that folks who are listening know how they can get in touch with you and what you offer in terms of information that they could glean. So could you share that information, please?
Sure. I publish a monthly newsletter. It is a labor of love as well as an albatross, but it's monthly. It's called Making the Connection, and it is available at www.lisapalm.com, and anybody who wants to can just send me a message through the website, and I put them on the mailing list. And I also use the newsletter as an opportunity to try to support the efforts of my entrepreneurial clients. So there are often announcements of client achievements or client events in the client corner of the newsletter.
That's fantastic. That's an awesome idea. I don't know many people who have newsletters for their own companies who are spending space or who dedicate space to helping other entrepreneurs by highlighting what's going on with them. That's a fantastic idea. How did you come up with it?
Well, I really think that when I was at NEC, I always felt like I had one foot in the legal department and one foot in the whatever the other department was that I was trying to support. And so I think from having worked in a big business for 15 years, I can offer my clients more than just legal services. You know, I do an awful lot of mentoring and business advice, and So I really become sort of a cheerleader for their business, and I really try to support them. And once I started the newsletter, it just seemed like a good thing to do, and they love it.
Well, I'm sure they do. It's quite innovative, and I'm really impressed by that. It's www.lisapalm.com.
Right. Yep, lisapalm.com.
Nice. It has a nice ring to it. Well, Lisa, thank you so very much for joining me on the show today. We are coming down to the last couple of minutes, and I have to say I've really enjoyed chatting with you and learning more about your background and what you do. Is there any last message that you'd like to put out?
Well, how about this? I also am on the board of directors of the New York State Dispute Resolution Association, and I am the conference chair for the 2012 conference, which will take place October 17th and 18th in Albany. And really my mission with NYSDRA is to try to be inclusive, and we have tracks for commercial, family, workplace, and community. And the goal is to try to interest and meet the needs of everybody in the dispute resolution community. So something will be going out very shortly about that, and so I'm glad to have the chance to give that a plug.
Fantastic. Thank you, Lisa, and I do hope that as many of you who are listening as possible and will share this information with others that you know, so that there is a wonderfully packed conference there in Albany in October, you said?
Right. The leaves should be beautiful.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yes, that's right. It will be fall foliage season, so that's great. Thank you so much again, Lisa, for joining me.
It was absolutely my pleasure.
Oh, well, thank you. Yes, of course, thank you. And likewise, as I was saying, thank you to everyone who's listening as well. I really do appreciate you joining in and listening to the show and supporting it. Do feel free to contact me via email at 123untangled.com. That's info, actually, info at 123untangled.com, with any questions, comments, concerns. Or if you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the show, please feel free to get in touch. I'm going to leave you now with a piece of music, and this is something that I enjoy doing. It's by an independent musician, and I love to support independent music. Her name is Somi, a beautiful young woman from Uganda and Rwanda, and she has been based in the United States and is now based in Nigeria. The song is called Prayer to the Saint of the Brokenhearted, and I encourage you to look her up, Somi, S-O-M-I, buy her music, support the independent musicians, and I hope you enjoy this. I will be back with you again next week with another new show. Have a wonderful week, everyone.
Come down and sweep over my bed, sweet saint of the broken hearted. Come down, down, down.
It's just like yesterday. Come down, down.